I'm going to talk about some work that I've been doing with Kevin and Natalie Paquette. Some published work and some a lot of work that will appear someday, this month, hopefully. Anyway, this work is about celestial holography, as you might have gathered from the abstract. So let me start with giving you a brief summary of the story so far. Celestial holography is an initiative to find a duality, a holographic duality, for quantum gravity in space-times with a vanishing cosmological constant. So the hope is that quantum gravity in lambda equals 0, 4D space-time, say, in asymptotically flat space-times, would be dual to some 2D CFT living on a celestial sphere, living on a Riemann sphere in general. And basically, in Lorentzian signature, where Andy Strominger first came up with these ideas, the hope was that you would have space-time, say an asymptotically flat space-time, there would be stuff going on in the center of space-time, and then somehow all the dynamics of that stuff would be dual to some theory living on the light cone cuts, some S2 cut of your asymptotic null infinity. Many bottom-up correspondences have been developed using this idea over the course of the last 10 years or so, I guess. But the question has always been, can we find any specific example of such a duality that realizes the bottom-up expectations concretely? If there wasn't, I wouldn't be giving the talk, of course, so let me. So what I've decided is not to give an introduction to celestial holography. I'm assuming everyone knows everything. I will not use any of the details, of course. I'll come back to all the details when I need them. But feel free to ask as many questions as you like. So today, we'll talk about a connection between twister theory and twisted holography. Oh, let's see if the other chalks are better. Nope. So the subject of twisted holography has been developed here at PI by Kevin and Davide. And the recent realization was that this could be applied basically as is to find a concrete version of celestial holography, at least in some very special contexts where the theory on space-time might have some integrability properties. How did this start? The story started with the discovery of something called W1 plus infinity algebra by Andy Strominger. And, more broadly by Guevara, Himwich, Pate, and Strominger. And this was basically the main hint. So, okay, the subject has been developing for the last 10 years. This happened in 2021.
This means I have preserving diffeomorphisms of this sphere?
Let's say, yes. Let me write it like that. It's the area preserving diffeomorphisms of a complex tuple. It's holomorphic symplectomorphisms of C2. Not the two sphere. Some people think it should be the two sphere, but.
No, I didn't know
that. Oh, okay. Sorry. There's a bit of a debate, so I was a bit scared. Sorry. Anyway, yeah. So this was a major hint, so it's worth mentioning this. What Kevin and Natalie realized was that this was the same algebra they were encountering in their analysis of twisted holography. Twisted holography is a version of holography for the B model topological strings, where you can have infinite dimensional symmetry enhancement that sort of resemble the same kind of symmetry enhancement that Andy Strominger and friends recognized in the asymptotics of flat space scattering amplitudes. So this was how celestial chiral algebras were born. Birth of celestial chiral algebras, which is basically a reinterpretation of the story about celestial holography and celestial OPEs that was spearheaded by Andy Strominger. It was a reinterpretation in the language of Kosuel duality by Kevin and Natalie. But this only goes so far as understanding the symmetry algebras. This still doesn't give you an actual holographic duality. To get an actual holographic duality, you have to study a genuine string theory setup. And that's what we have done in that set of works. So that's what I'm going to describe today. So today we'll have an actual...
Now that the cube is true, can you remind me how this Hamiltonian diffeomorphisms of situ, sort of appear in the celestial story?
It's a long story, so I thought I might...
Okay,
well,
sorry.
Let me just give you, in words, basically what happens is that you study scattering amplitudes in gravity, in GR, and then you study the collinear limits of these scattering amplitudes. The collinear limits in that diagram can be drawn as limits. Suppose you're scattering a pair of particles with null momenta p1 and p2. The collinear limit is the limit when these null momenta sort of coincide or become collinear. Well, they come close together. In this limit, the scattering amplitudes contain universal singular behavior, and this singular behavior happens to be exactly a two-particle singularity of some CFT kind of behavior. And that's why Strominger and friends conjectured that scattering amplitudes will be correlators of some putative CFT, and this singular behavior will be realized as the OPE expansion in this 2D CFT. And basically, when they decomposed this behavior in terms of some kind of generators, some kind of degrees of freedom of the particles in the bulk, they landed on generators of W1 plus of Ham C2. Yeah.
That was like the geometry is
and the C2 in the geometry is secretly related to the fibers of something called twister space. So that was the interpretation that, let me cite myself, I found with Tim Adamo and Lionel Mason, my PhD supervisor, and Kevin and Natalie also found a more abstract version of it through the Kosuel duality analysis.
You're also saying that if you know that the Kosuel duality is the same as the world sheet of least theory, you already kind of know directly and not connected to the diffeomorphism of the two.
Not... Yeah, I'm not sure I'd call it direct,
but
you can guess a realization in terms of a natural 2D CFT that lives on twister space.
Yeah, your paper is deriving an answer,
right? Yes, from an actual... Yes, exactly. Exactly. You can find an explicit conformal block realizing this algebra. Okay, so none of that... Well, parts of that will appear today. I decided to keep, instead of giving a huge survey talk, I decided to delve into a little bit of details. So, because there are so many people who do twisted holography and celestial holography here, so I wanted it to be a bit fun. But if I'm going too fast, please stop me as many times as you like. So number two, what I'm going to show you is how you obtain a specific asymptotically flat spacetime from brain back reaction in a topological string theory. So section two is going to be, well, I've called it twisted holography on twister space. Maybe I'll just say twistorial holography. So let's see exactly what's the simplest setup imaginable. So let me remind you of what twister space is. If you have a Riemannian four-manifold, I'm going to work in Euclidean signature. So it's going to be a toy model of celestial holography. Do not shoot me. But okay, let's pick a Riemannian manifold M. with the Euclidean signature metric G. This is some four-dimensional space-time. And I'll very cleverly not put a hyphen in the space-time. Penrose would be very angry at that. He would say he doesn't like spaghettomy, but I think if we have just working Euclidean signature, we can do that. Suppose if you have a Riemannian manifold like this, its twisted space is basically a very simple sphere bundle. It's a sphere bundle that is given concretely by the projective spinner bundle. Projective Weyl spinner bundle over M. It's basically in pictures, you have your space-time M, and there will be some sphere fibers, and there will be points of space-time, and every point of space-time will have its own sphere fiber, and these sphere fibers are called twister lines, in the sense that they're going to do complex geometry, so they're projective lines, CP1s. That's the general picture. Oh, two-spinner bundle in the sense that if you take two component spinners, you have C2 fibers and you projectivize them, then you get CP1 or sphere fibers. And even if the two-spinner bundle is not globally defined, even if M is not spin, you can define the projective spinner bundle. So it's a very general procedure. The main theorem by Atiyah, Hitchensinger, and Penrose before him, in the 80s, is that Z is a complex manifold with a very specific complex structure, very natural complex structure, in which all these spheres become holomorphically embedded in this complex manifold, if and only if the Weyl tensor of G is half flat. So half the Weyl tensor should vanish, the right moving part of the Weyl, the left moving part of the Weyl tensor should vanish. This is just meant to be a summary. You don't need to remember all the details. We're going to work with a very concrete model. We're going to start with the twister space of flat space, which is conventionally denoted PT. And I'm going to directly tell you what this is as a complex manifold. So as a complex manifold, it is the total space of the rank 2 vector bundle O1 plus O1, which is a vector bundle over CP1. For people who might be unfamiliar, basically you can construct it by some patching functions. You put coordinates, CP1 is S2, you put a stereographic coordinate Z on this S2, and suppose you pick a pair of complex coordinates, which sort of conventionally Kevin and Natalie decided to pick V's, so I'm going to go with that. And alpha dot is basically going to be a two-spinner index. Unfortunately or fortunately, Witten picked alpha dots for these things, so we're going to go with alpha dot, not alphas. And basically, twister space looks like a bundle. This is a P1, CP1. There are C2 fibers here, V1 and V2 go like that. And CP1 is covered by two patches, Z0 equals to 0 and Z0 equals to infinity. And you can patch the fibers under that patching by the following patch transition function. And this is the transition function that sort of gives it the structure of the specific bundle O1 plus O1. Okay, I'm going slowly. Any questions about this construction? If people are not from,
okay. So you haven't explained how it connects to your previous.
Yes, I'm good. Oh, right, sorry. I forgot to write notes on that. So I should say, this can be viewed as a smooth manifold. This can be viewed as the bundle R4 cross the CP1, R4 cross S2. All bundles on R4 are trivial anyway. So it's just R4 cross CP1. And there's a smooth diffeomorphism, not holomorphic, but smooth diffeomorphism that exhibits this structure. And this is given by basically giving equations of those spheres as embedded varieties inside this big space. The equations look like, thank you, this actually helps me set up some notation.
Thanks,
okay, u alpha dot plus z u hat alpha dot, where u alpha dot, basically people might be familiar with coordinates x alpha dot on spacetime, double null coordinates, they go with various names. You can set x1 alpha dot to u alpha dot and x2 alpha dot to u hat alpha dot. In Euclidean signature, u hat happens to be minus of u bar 2 and u bar 1. This is a natural, this is called an anti-holomorphic involution. This is called quaternionic conjugation. It's like a mixture of complex functions. And this is a diffeomorphism from v comma z coordinates to u, u hat, z coordinates that expresses pt as something diffeomorphic to R4 cross CP1, and that connects with that picture. Thanks, that was a useful question. All right.
Just a space in the hyperkähler sense.
Just a space in the hyperkähler sense, exactly. Yeah, it's just usually easier to say two spinner bundle in physics, yeah. Okay, let's rub that off. So what we want to do is study the topological B model on this space. But unfortunately, this space is not collabial. And if you want to study topological strings, it's a famous ish result that you'd need a holomorphic volume form. There is no holomorphic, there's no global holomorphic, so 3-0 volume form. Because the naive volume form that you would have constructed, dz, wedge dv1, wedge dv2, under the coordinate transformation, zv goes to 1 over z, v over z, like in the other patch, it acquires a fourth order pole, which is sad. So you can't study topological strings directly on this geometry. So what Kevin and I, Natalie, have sort of decided slash conjectured is that you can study topological strings on a very closely related geometry. Simply remove the poles of some measure and you get something nice. So there's a beautiful theorem that allows us to do this. So let me mention the theorem first, the general theorem, because it'll come, you'll encounter it again, and then I'll tell you how it works in this case. So there's a theorem that saves the day. It's by Massimiliano Pontecorvo. Pontecorvo's theorem says the following. Suppose G is always self-dual, so it's wild, half of its wild density is always going to vanish. I'm going to assume that. Suppose G is SD self-dual as well as scalar. If G is self-dual and scalar, then something very beautiful happens. Then you can find a global section omega check. Sorry for the ancient notation. You can find a global section of the canonical of the inverse square root of the canonical bundle. So suppose we call this space Z. The canonical bundle is the space of 3-0 forms. Its square root exists, which is a result by Hitchin. And if G is also scalar, then you can find a global section of kz to the minus half. And what does such a global section look like? In drawing, in pictures, it basically looks like, it looks like a conic section in your twister space. Suppose this is your twister space. You can find a conic section such that omega check is zero at exactly 2 points on each twister line. So basically a conic section, it'll be a quadratic polynomial in coordinates, and it will intersect each twister line at exactly 2 points. And in this sense, and this is otherwise a global section, so you can define a volume form now. And here's a clever trick. Since this is a section of k^-1/2, you can define a tree form, which is just omega checked to the -2. And the beautiful bit is that it's almost everywhere non-singular, except for a controlled set of points given by Pontecorvo's quadric. That thing is a degree 2 polynomial in coordinates, so it's called a quadric. So this is only singular along that sort of conic section that I drew. So this is a metamorphic tree form. And if you subtract the points, if you subtract the zero locus of the surface, then you get a genuine Calabi-Yau. Then you get a Calabi-Yau tree form. You also have to assume that there's a Kähler metric, but the twister space I'm going to study will have a Kähler structure. So it'll be a Calabi-Yau threefold. And these things we interpret as defects in our string setup. And these are the things that we least understand from a string theory perspective. But other than that, right now we're just conjecturing that there is some notion of defects that can give rise to some kind of boundary conditions at this quadric that we are removing from our space. This is what Andy hates.
Should I worry about Lorentz invariants?
Sorry, yeah?
Should I worry about Lorentz invariants?
Thank you. Oh, this is... Yes, so it breaks Lorentz invariants. Good, yes. It's just that we're going to work in a... Actually, I was going to come to that. Like, we're going to back react, and then we will work in a geometry which has, like, a smaller isometry group. So the defects break exact... Yeah. The defects, to be precise, pick a complex structure on R4, and the choice of complex structure breaks SO4 down to U2. This is in the hyperkähler sense, it picks a complex structure. But I don't want to remind people too much. Okay, so I have time. Now, but Pontecorvo's theorem doesn't end here. Pontecorvo goes further. And he gives a Kähler metric. I said that metric is Kähler. You can find the Kähler form of the metric directly from the data of this quadric. And that's very simple. Take the tree form, Pontecorvo's tree form, and do a contour integral along one of the poles of your section. Divide by 2 pi to get the right normalization. And this gives you the Kähler form of G. And this is a very useful formula when you're going to compactify along these S2s to get a theory on spacetime. This is where the data of the metric of the asymptotically flat spacetime enters the B model.
Is that the form of the class?
No, this is the form. This is the form. It's, yeah. You can show that it's closed by some general calculation. Yeah. Okay. Any questions until now? This was a review of like stuff done in the 80s.
In terms of that picture, that picture proceeding, did you draw the loop? What is the loci at which this
basically it'll be 2 points on each of these spheres. And it'll be like a smoothly interpolating between all of these points. Basically just draw like this locus. And that would be your conic section.
It'll be like a translation symmetry.
It definitely, yeah. Again, choice of Kähler structure breaks Poincaré to U2. Doesn't? What is translation symmetry? Translations is. So it still has some kind of complex translation symmetry. U goes to U plus something. Like in complex coordinate goes to complex coordinate plus something complex. Okay, sure, sorry, it doesn't break translation in that sense. I had the back reactor geometry in mind, which does not have translation in it. Okay, sorry, where was I? Yeah. Any other questions?
Yeah,
Now we're going to use this theorem. So we use this theorem to construct a nice quadric. And the quadric is going to be the first thing that comes to your mind. It's literally going to be, well, I said quadratic polynomial, but a quadratic polynomial can also be linear. So I'm going to choose my quadric, make a check, equals z in those coordinates on PT. I'm back at PT, and I'm going to choose the quadric omega check equals z. This gives me the volume form omega equals dz, wedge dv1, wedge dv2, over z squared. And this volume form has now a second order pole at z equals 0. And when you do an inversion, it has a second order pole at infinity. So you remove the locus z equals 0, infinity. So basically, in that vibration picture, you'd have a line, a sphere. You'd have 0, infinity. You just remove the fibers over these two points. And then that gives you your Calabi-Yau geometry on which we're going to study the B model. Now, let's do that. What is the B model? Obviously, I'm not going to be able to describe everything about the B model in a lecture, so I'm just going to tell you what is the field content and what is the equations of motion. Basic stuff. So the B model closed strings deals with...
Just C times C times C star, right?
Yes. That thing? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, still a non-trivial bundle.
No.
I suppose not, yeah. Once you've removed these points, it's probably not.
Take advantage of the boundary conditions. I know you don't explain them.
On the fields, yes. Now, as a bundle, it probably becomes trivial now, because C star bundles are probably trivial. Anyway.
So originally you said there is no global form of the system space, and then you put this construction back.
So this is no longer global. This is only holomorphic away from 0 and infinity. Right? Yeah, that's why I had to harken back to the 80s. But we will come back to that theorem. Pontecorvo still has more stuff to say. Okay, so anyway, the B model deals with complex structure deformation. In the physical string, closed string theory, the closed string modes are metric perturbations. In the B model, they instead become complex structure deformations of some algebraic variety that you start with. So a complex structure deformation is most efficiently described as a perturbation of the D bar operator. So the D bar operator is just dz bar. This is just the D bar operator of the geometry I start with. I'm going to use the convention that the complex conjugate of a dotted object is an undotted object. The closed string B model deals with complex structure deformations, turns on something called a Beltrami differential, which is basically an anti-holomorphic differential form with coefficients in the holomorphic tangent bundle. So just to give some examples, it might look like some dz bar times some function f times d by dz and stuff like that. Okay? It's basically an anti-holomorphic differential form with coefficients in holomorphic vector fields. So it's like a gauge field in some sense, like a connection. And the deformed complex, this is called a deformed almost complex structure. There's a notion of a complex structure. So d bar plus mu is a complex structure if there's a specific flat connection type equation of motion that mu has to satisfy, which is known as the Mora-Curtin equation. I think in this context, it was found by Kudaira and Spencer. All right. The idea is that once you have a... No worries. The idea is that if this equation of motion holds, then you can find new complex coordinates on your manifold that are holomorphic with respect to this operator. Okay? So new complex coordinates that might look like d bar plus mu some coordinates wi equals. We don't want to just study the B model. We want to study the B model in the presence of D brains. So what we're going to do is, we're going to take that picture, and we're going to wrap a stack of n D-even brains along this S2. Sorry, I should have gotten a red chalk or something. So basically wrap n D1s along the locus V alpha dot equals 0, which is basically the 0 section of that vibration, just the line I've drawn. And these D1s at the level of equations of motion add sources. The equation of motion is that. So the sourced, this doesn't move, sorry. So what is a sourced equation of motion? Oh, I can just use this one now. I've got more boards here now. This gives me Cambridge vibes. Anyway. So the sourced EOM is d bar mu plus half mu comma mu equals a source that's localized in the sense of a delta function along that locus. So basically, a delta function in V. And the source has to be a vector field. The vector field has to be d by dz. You can basically add a source term to your action and do all kinds of quantum field theory shenanigans to get some sourced equation of motion. Because the volume form has a factor of 1 over z squared there, you know how when you have volume forms and factors of square root of g, a metric determinant, your delta functions then come with the factors of 1 over the square root of the metric? It's the same thing. There's a z squared there, so you get a z squared in the definition of your delta function as well. You can derive this by writing down an action and all. The nice thing is that Kevin and Davide found, and I basically mimicked, is that you can find a solution of this equation. So there's something beautiful in the literature called the Bochner-Martinelli kernel that allows you to do this. Basically, construct a solution that is sort of proportional to a single differential form so that this mu comma mu object, this actually contains a wedge product. Construct a solution so that mu wedge mu vanishes. And then you get a simpler equation to solve. And you can solve this explicitly in terms of something called, basically explicitly in terms of the inverse of this d bar operator. And the solution is very simple. I forgot I'm wrapping n d brains, so there's an n. The amount of sources is n. You wrap it, you solve this, and then you get the following solution. Mod v1 squared plus mod v2 squared, the whole squared. In the future, I'm going to call this mod v squared times this z squared dz factor just comes along for the ride. Why does this work? This is basically a two-dimensional analog of the hopefully familiar magic identity d, say, dv 1 over v bar equals delta bar of v, well, delta 2 of v. I'm assuming people are familiar with this identity in one complex dimensions. 1 over v bar is the kernel of d by dv. Sorry, what am I doing? D by dv bar. Sorry, yeah. That identity should be familiar. This is just a two-dimensional analog known as the Bochner-Martinelli kernel. And so once you have a solution.
There's some bar subsets.
This is the anti-holomorphic objects. Thank you. Good. you can show that this vanishes when you act with dbar. This vanishes everywhere except for the singular locus. All right, this is the solution. How does it relate to?
Side disk seems to be treating anorganic
slightly afraid. Okay, hopefully I'm not boring people because I find this back reaction story very pretty. Okay, we're almost there. In the next 5 minutes, I'll give you an asymptotically flat space time. Yeah.
What happens to the,
Oh, the equation of motion is fine. That's why I did not write the action very cleverly. Yeah. Do you want me to? No, I'm not writing. I hope that's okay. The Kodaira-Spencer action for the action for that equation of motion is a non-local action that was found by Bishatsky, Chakotay, Uguri, and Waffa, I think. And basically, it's non-local because mu has some mu is like a Beltrami, so it has a vector field. So sometimes you have to invert that vector field part to get something you can integrate. Anyway, summary: you get a back-reacted geometry from twister space. But what is the new object that you got? You put some brains in twister space, allowed them to source a new field, but have you got a new twister space? And the answer is yes. The really magical bit was that this geometry is actually, again, the twister space of an asymptotically flat spacetime. So what is that? So again, you have a complex manifold. You have to construct holomorphic coordinates to figure out what that complex manifold really is as a manifold. Holomorphic coordinates are very easy to construct. V alpha dot are automatically annihilated by the deformed d bar operator because the deformation is purely along the z direction. D by dz gives 0 on V alpha dot. But there are two more holomorphic coordinates that you can construct. D bar plus mu w alpha dot equals 0, where w alpha dot has the expression V alpha dot over z minus n V hat alpha dot over mod V squared, where V hat, as you might remember, is minus V bar 2 V bar 1. So these are the complex coordinates. But these are four complex coordinates. OK, these are complex coordinates in the patch Z not equal to 0. There are some subtleties, but nothing too annoying. These are four complex coordinates on a three complex dimensional manifold, though they have to be interrelated. And the interrelation is very easy to find. This is another beautiful magical bit. If you compute epsilon alpha dot beta dot, this is the 2 by 2 Levi-Civita symbol, V alpha dot W alpha dot V beta dot, then actually just, if you plug V alpha dot in here, the antisymmetry kills that term. The only term that survives is the V hat term, and there's a beautiful identity. V hat beta dot equals mod V squared, which basically cancels the denominator and leaves you with a factor of n. So you realize that if you write this as a conditioned determinant of the matrix formed out of columns W and V is n, then this is just SL to C. As long as n is positive, the back reaction just generates SL to C for you. All right, how do you see SL to C as being the twister space of some four manifold? Any questions about that calculation?
When it is equal to 0, it's equal to infinity, loss cycle. I assume you're still missing some of the z equal to 0 is equal to infinity loss in some sense.
Yeah, we are sort of, we have excised those divisors. So I think we're just going to, yeah, we, Yeah, right now they're gone. There might be a better way to think about them. Huh?
They are important.
They're there in a convoluted sense. I'll draw a picture in a bit.
I mean, now the part that we're supposed to see has all these places together.
Yes. And we have to put boundary conditions, but yeah, at the moment they're conjectural. I guess in that sense they're important, right? We have to put boundary conditions there. I have to ask him, obviously. Anyway, sorry. Yeah, let's show how SL2C, why is SL2C a twister space? Well, it's almost a twister space. It'll basically be twister space where the fibers will again be missing the zero and infinity. All the spheres that I drew on my first board, they will again be missing zero and infinity, the north and south poles. So up to that, it'll be a twister space of some space-time. How do you see this? So to construct a space-time out of this, you have to exhibit SL2C as a sphere bundle over some asymptotically flat four manifold. And there's a very beautiful and very simple diffeomorphism that allows you to do this. So there's a very nice diffeomorphism. You have to go and dig at the Hutchinson and things like that to find this, but once you find it, it's very clean. I think it was written explicitly by Ward. And in the case of CP2, which is a closely related space. So here's a change of coordinates from SL to, well, okay. A map from C2 minus the origin across the sphere minus its north and south poles to SL2C. Suppose you put some coordinates u alpha dot in C2 minus 0, as we started with, and put a stereographic coordinate. It's no longer going to be z. That z is gone. The new stereographic coordinate is called sigma. And there's a very cute embedding. So we have v alpha dot equals u alpha dot plus sigma rho u hat alpha dot, and w alpha dot equals u hat alpha dot plus 1 over sigma rho bar u alpha dot, where basically the condition v alpha dot, well, determinant w comma v equals n becomes the condition that mod rho squared, there's this weird quantity here, mod rho squared has to be 1 over n plus mod u squared. So this provides you almost a diffeomorphism from C2. It provides you an embedding of C2 minus the origin times the sphere bundle over that into SL2C. There's some points that are of SL2C that are still missed in this diffeomorphism. And it turns out that these points correspond to a diffeomorphism. You can extend it to a diffeo from the blow up of C2 at the origin to SL2C, and then you get a genuine diffeomorphism. So in that sense, what's happened is that at the level of space-time, putting D brains on the twister line corresponding to the origin of space-time has blown up the origin into a whole CP1. The blow-up geometry basically looks like C2 minus the origin times you replace the origin by a copy of CP1 at the origin. Union, I guess. All right, so there you can get a genuine diffeomorphism. And now let's use Pontecorvo again to get a metric on this spacetime. Let's see. What is this mysterious metric that the back reaction will generate for us dynamically? It's the question. And what are its properties? Very simple. Pontecorvo says, construct a volume form in SL2C. Volume form in SL2C is very easy to construct. It's just a Poincaré residue on the equation of SL2C. Starting from C4, coordinates VW on C4, you can take a residue. So n minus time alpha dot beta dot. This volume form looks something like, say, dv1 wedge d2w over v2, oh, w1, something like that. You can compute a residue. And you use this volume form to compute. Basically, you take that volume form, pull it back by that diffeomorphism, by that embedding. And when you do that, you'll find a pole at the location sigma equals 0. Basically, just a pullback of the diffeomorphism. And this procedure will give you a closed and co-closed differential form on C2 minus the origin, which turns out to be the scalar form of the metric that we are after. And this scalar form happens to be a scalar form that's supposedly can be found in Griffiths and Harris, but I have been unable to locate it. So I'm just going to call it the Burns metric because it was discussed by Daniel Burns in a seminar whose proceedings you cannot discover. So the name that usually goes, so this procedure explicitly was carried out, this procedure to go from twister space to spacetime was carried out by Claude Lebrun. He's a very nice guy you should meet. Yes, please. Good question. Let's draw the picture. I'm very happy about this picture because I drew it yesterday while typing out my draft. It would probably still not go into the draft because I'm terrible at takes. So, Kevin and Davide realized that there's a very nice, well, I suppose, I don't know who originally realized this, but there's a very natural map from SL to C. Well, SL to C is basically a S3 bundle over ADS3. SL to C has a natural group action by SU2 on the right, viewed as matrices. And if you quotient SL to C by that group action, SL to C mod SU2 right, you get a copy of ADS3. And now we can sort of have a picture of the space. The space that we have produced is ADS3 cross S3. That means we're on the right track. We wanted holography. We've got ADS. And now, don't laugh, getting there. That procedure tells us that if we compactify on these spheres, basically if we start with some three-form on twister space, and if we do this contour integral to remove the sphere dependence, then it gives us a scalar form on C2 minus the origin. This allows us to draw a nice picture of it. So ADS3 is a hyperboloid, right? And then there's an S3 factor, which I'm going to neglect. The boundary of ADS3 is a sphere. You can pick a pair of defects on the sphere. And this is basically your choice of quadric here. What you can do is, this sort of emerges from the whole procedure. We sort of made some choices here. You can sort of choose anything. So there's a whole two-sphere worth of choices that you can have made for this quadric. Any one, so there's some hidden SL to C here that we're sort of discovering when we compute scattering amplitudes and all. And we think that there is some, it's sort of emerging from this picture. And these twister lines can be drawn as very nice curves in this picture. So basically, they're curves that are sort of extended along this ADS direction. So they're curves that look like this.
That's
star
in SL to C.
C star. Sorry, what did you say?
Cartans of SL to C.
Cartans of SL to C.
Like C star.
Yeah. I haven't checked that. Maybe.
I mean, is this the sample in S3?
Yeah. So these are the drawings of the twister lines. Each of these are two spheres. Basically, you can't embed a whole two sphere. You can only embed it once you remove 0 and infinity. So they sort of end at 0 and infinity. And the two sphere that goes straight through corresponds to the points on the blow up of the origin. So those are the ones that sort of you have to, the scalar form doesn't extend across the blow up, but when you derive the scalar metric associated to this, so the, that's known as Burns metric. It looks something like the flat metric plus U1 DU2 minus U2 DU1 absolute value squared divided by mod U to the 4 times factor of n. It so happens that this metric has the right homogeneity to extend across the blow up. And so that's the geometry, people. Now I'm going to do something extremely dumb. I have the V model on this space. That's an ADS3 cross S3. I'm very happy. I just went back to old-fashioned holography. But I'm going to compactify along these lines. So each of these is a copy of S2. Compactify modulo boundary conditions because they're secretly non-compact. So you compactify along these lines, and you basically just get R plus a theory. So B model, can people see here? I don't know if people can see here. I can't move this.
And then R cross S3 is supposed to be the
R cross S3 is just R4 minus the origin, which is your space time. Oh, I'm doing Euclidean, so it's probably not much of a meaning in Einstein's window. No, it's not that Einstein cylinder. It's the Euclidean analog of the hyperbolic foliation. In Lorentzian, you get ADS and DS foliations. This is an S3 foliation in R4. It's the analog of that. Anyway, so I do the genius thing of compactifying along these lines, and then that gets a theory on basically B model compactified on the S2 compactified down to R plus cross S3, which is just our C2 minus the origin geometry. Okay, that's the story. Now I'll just mention the actions and conclude. So if anyone has any questions about this procedure, feel free to ask now or later. The actual. It's gone. It's gone. Let's get to it. Let's extend the talk by 15 minutes and get to. No, just kidding. Okay, so let me get to the actual space-time duality. All of this was just like I wanted to share with you guys how the duality comes about, but now let's get to the actual duality. I haven't told you what the dual theory is and all that stuff, all the good stuff. So the precise setup involves putting a stack of nd1 brains along that CP1 in twister space, but we also wrap, say, z direction, v1 direction, v2 direction. We also wrap, you have nd1 brains here, and you wrap 4d5s that are twister space filling. And there's an orientable projection that takes you to a type 1 model of the B model. There are some details which are not that important. So these engineer some kind of a flavor. Well, these engineer some kind of a matter. The dual celestial CFT is going to live on the world volume of these D1 brains. And that can now be drawn in pictures. You have a spherical D1 brain stack. You have a bunch of space-filling D5 brains. Four of them. You can have strings, B model closed strings that stretch from here to the same stack. So we use the notation x alpha dot ij for these, where the so this setup engineers an SPN gauge theory on the world volume of this stack. And the fields, the sort of gravitational modes that measure the fluctuations of the stack, contain a normal index. This is a normal bundle index. And then they live in the antisymmetric square of the fundamental representation of SPN. So ij go from 1 up to 2n. And this is antisymmetric in ij. There are also d1, d5 strings, which stretch like this. These are open string modes. and these are I. There's an index R, which corresponds to a flavor index. Basically, we have four D5 brains, and it engineers an SO8 on the world volume of the D1 brains, matter in SO8. And so R happens to be an index in the vector of SO8. And there's one end, so Chan Patton factor, there's one end on the ND1 brain, so it gets a factor of I, which is the SPN, and one end on the, you know, D5 brains. Good. So that's the matter content of the theory. And the OPEs of the theory, because this is a topological string, are super duper easy to read off. IJ. Actually forgot, probably some anomaly cancellation business.
Is that to take type 1 instead of 1?
Why did we take type 1? I forgot.
Well, if you didn't see type, before we type 2 topology string, we had some indeed variable space time, which involves terminology, scary things.
Please try, and we'll all be happy. Anyway, sorry. So we have epsilon ik jl over z. That's the OPE. Basically, it's free field OPEs. And the only non-triviality comes because this is a gauge theory. So you have to gauge these free field OPEs by the SPN gauge group ij 0 delta rs epsilon ij over z. Where these epsilons are the skew forms of SPN, and this is the 2x2 Levi-Civita. Okay. These are the OPEs, that's it. And more the BRST gauge picks and all do the usual stuff in the BRST cohomology. There are some ghosts and stuff you can add and do computations at loop level. This is the first example of celestial CFT.
But wait, you had the zero at infinity, I assume.
Yes, okay. Let's tell you the boundary conditions that we are conjecturing. Since we removed the divisors z equals 0 and infinity, there have to be boundary conditions. And the boundary conditions are that x alpha dot goes like, it has a simple pole at z equals 0 and infinity. And the i's in our latest iteration have branch cut square root poles at 0 and infinity. Okay. At 0 and infinity. I have a bit of a geometric understanding of this because it's used in constructing hyperkähler metrics.
What's the residue of that?
What is that?
What's the coefficient
of the Fanon-Gracie? Oh, well, it'll be some classical section of some word bundle. There's a holomorphic vector bundle, SO8 bundle on space-time. It'll correspond to some SO8 bundle on twisted space.
It's fine, there is one other, but what about the X's?
The X's. Oh, that's actually easier. The coefficient is something like, I don't know what the IJ bit is. It's probably just epsilon IJ, I don't remember. But the alpha dot bit corresponds to the complex coordinate in space-time. It's like that picks the complex structure on your space-time. Do you have any better idea for what's the coefficient of the residue at the singularities?
I think in the module, the place it's equal to 0. You say you can have an append. I'll show you first of all, the coefficient is always.
Right. Like, sure. There's a bit of freedom here. We don't know exactly what the residue should be. I guess that's the point here.
Yeah.
That we can. Our general idea is to just allow for all possibilities and then make a correspondence between calculations in space-time that might give rise to those possibilities as correlators in non-trivial modules of the chiral algebra. And we haven't done that yet. There's like a...
If you want to take right one, all of the transient elements have some s to 0, what's the most general thing I can.
Yeah. It's an interesting bulk analysis as well. Anyway, let me finish off. Let me just tell you the... Okay, let me just tell you in words.
Do you have to do something there? So, or would you just not do anything fancy there?
in the calculations that we have done for scattering amplitudes in this Burns geometry, for the states that we have scattered, like the specific states, it turns out that there was zero residue. Basically, those boundary conditions did not contribute. And now our conjecture slash guess is that when we compute more complicated observables like form factors instead of scattering amplitudes, then they might generate non-trivial poles at the loci of these defects in the correlation functions. And then we'll hope to find some kind of a priori way of directly generating them from the chiral algebra, but we haven't reached that stage yet. They just haven't appeared. There's some weird, this is the hidden SL2C symmetry that we are confused about. It seems that there's some, as I said, there's some choice of poles that one makes here on the boundary of ADS3 that corresponds to this choice of defects before back reaction. And it seems that one could have rotated, like changed, there's a whole two-sphere worth of choice of quadrics. And this two-sphere worth of quadrics, if somehow averages out and restores some SU2 symmetry associated to that S2. That's the rough conjecture slash hope.
What is the celestial sphere at the moment?
The celestial sphere is just the name for the twister line, for the place where the stack of demon brains lives. It was basically the zero section of O1 plus O1.
When you convert to scattering amplitudes, it must be the case that now a local operator placed at some point on this sphere goes in some direction in the quark space.
Exactly. Well, since we're Euclidean, we have to do some analytic continuation to compute scattering amplitudes. So we construct some plane wave states in Lorentzian and compute the amplitude using analytic continuation, and then we get a rational answer as predicted by the chiral algebra.
What's the algebra of the space respect?
The isometry group. The isometry group of this metric is basically, one starts with the SU2 left cross SU2 right of flat space. And the SU2 right survives as is, because this is sort of covariant in the dotted indices. But this one gets broken down to U1 left. So it's basically a U2 that preserves mod U. Translations are broken as well, which is why there are no momentum conserving delta functions. Life is not real world, but it's good. Life is good, yeah. Any other questions? This metric is not Einstein. This metric is, I was going to write the theory that this metric lives in. So the B model, when compactified down to space-time, does not give you general relativity or a subsector of general relativity. It instead gives you conformal gravity, like a subsector of self-dual subsector of conformal gravity. And this metric, it's not Ricci flat or Einstein, but instead, the equation of motion that it satisfies is scalar flatness. So it's basically scalar flat and Kähler. This is the equation of motion. So it's a subsector of conformal gravity. We haven't managed to engineer self-dual Einstein gravity yet, though there are avenues on the horizon for doing that.
So would you say
that there's a doubling of symmetries in this theory. Yeah, they're like, in some sense, two copies of W infinity, because this happens, this equation of motion is a fourth order equation of motion. In fact, just to summarize, the gravitational theory that you get from compactifying the B model along those twister lines is basically a theory that governs scalar flat Kähler perturbations of this metric. And then, that theory, it's not subdual GR,
I have some trouble talking about scattering without having a symmetry which is not Euclidean. Which recotations are allowed on the Burns metric? Can you recotate the metric?
You can recrotate the metric in a formal sense. So the metric develops some singularities, but you can still do some calculations in the sense of some regularization and stuff.
Choosing signature, or
you can vic rotate it to Lorentzian. It's as a self-dual metric, so it becomes a complex metric. It's no longer a real metric in Lorentzian signature.
But what Chukwuchu could be a real metric in Chukwuchu signature?
It becomes a real metric in 2,2 signature. So you can compute amplitudes in 2,2 signature. We haven't needed, I just computed using analytic continuation to Lorentzian because, actually, I did not compute it. That's the fun part. Hawking, Page, and Pope computed the amplitude to the two-point amplitude in 1979 by doing this analytic continuation. And all I had to do was look at their expression, translate it in square and angle brackets, and then, boom, it just matched the expectation from the chiral algebra. And that sort of helped me build a holographic dictionary, associate operators to states, things like that. They did it in like a Lorentzian signature continuation. So it's a bit of an open problem to do it properly, like fully safely. Oh, you have a singularity across the whole light cone of u equals 0 in 2,2. There are ways of getting around that, but they're a bit weird in their own rights.
Yes. Yes, you blow up the light cone.
I don't know what that means. I don't know what blowing up. So the cuts of the light cone are CP1, so we can blow them up. That just becomes CP1 times CP1. But the whole light cone itself, no idea really.
After backtracking on the V1 rings, there's still the V5 strings. Do you expect that to show up in the theory? Who's that measure for solution?
Oh, I didn't write down the space time action. Well, I suppose they would. They wouldn't decouple in the near horizon limit or something? The D5 ones? We can talk about, I guess, I don't think I understand. Yeah, okay. I'm not entirely sure. You see, I'm not a string theorist myself. I've learned it from Kevin. But hopefully I managed to give an idea of how the back reaction is happening. Hopefully that was clear now. Okay, let me just say the theory that you get on space-time by compactification is a combination of self-dual Kähler conformal gravity coupled to some matter sector that looks like a four-dimensional Vesumino-Witten model. It's all in the paper if anyone's interested, of course. And we can compute scattering states in that theory. There's a very nice Laplace equation on Born space, which you can solve using tricks from Hawking, Page, and Pope. Thank you, Don Page and Chris Pope. Always say that. Scooping me 20 years ago for the last 3 years. And and then you can compute solutions, and you can compute scattering amplitudes. And in fact, I am trying to compute more scattering amplitudes with the Walker, Melton, and Shruti Narayan's help. Yeah, let's see if that goes anywhere. They're very hard calculations, but they can be done. The beauty of the dual CFT, it's gone. The beauty of the dual CFT is that the calculations simplify drastically, at least at tree level, because it's a free chiral algebra at tree level. In the large n limit, in the dual CFT, you have to think of it as a calculation in the planar limit. There's a parameter n, which is the rank of the SPN group, and the calculations really simplify. And you can do the calculation of, say, the two-point scattering amplitude on Born space through the chiral algebra in two lines and one diagram. And in through direct calculation in the bulk, takes you 10 pages or a quick perusal of Hawking, Page, and Pope. Okay, let me see if there are any future directions I want to. I think I should stop there. Yeah, so plenty of future directions, build more dualities, help us out.
Strings?
The V model.
as beam, planes, right? Not just strings.
The B model planes.
No, the B model as a theory, right? As
yeah.
Brains.
Yeah.
Strings.
So.
For example, if I can put a determinant operator in that in the car algebra, because it's going to be whatever.
Now, we've been, Kevin and I, like multiple people have been chatting about this. So you would, I still don't know the full setup. So presumably in this ADS3 cross S3 picture, this is your giant graviton story, yes, presumably.
Yes.
These are D1 brains
yes.
that stretch between points.
Yes.
So in this picture, there might be analogous to some of these curves. Oh, but they might be more general. They might not be two spheres, but like, they'll end at start at some point, but they might fluctuate more generally and constrained by some holomorphic equation. But yeah, other than that, we haven't really looked at their space-time compactification version. Yeah, they'll probably still be. Yeah, it's unclear whether they'll be extended objects because the ADS3 itself is collapsing. I'm compactifying along the S2 fiber, this S2 foliation of ADS3.
They might remain two-dimensional.
Yeah. So.
Strings.
Yeah, they might look like, at best, they might look like strings. At worst, maybe like points. If they overlap with one of these curves, then they'll look like points. So it'll be interesting. That's an open, interesting question.
But could you technically try to map the construction to the logical operator?
Yeah, that's the open question. What is the celestial, like in an extrapolate type dictionary, just starting from your field theory on space-time. So what are the is there any non-perturbative object in celestial holography that might correspond to some extent, like behave like a, yeah, it might be some, maybe there's some monopoles or something like that. I don't know if that's related to this giant graviton story, but yeah. Thanks. That's an interesting question.
If not, we're going to have to dinner.